This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Steven Siegel. And I'll be speaking today with my guest, Dr. Sarah J. Young. Sarah J. Young has a new book. It's called Writing Resistance, Revolutionary Memoirs of Schlüsselburg Prison, published by UCL Press, University College London in 2021. And thanks so much, Sarah, for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for inviting me.
So a little about our author today, Dr. Sarah J. Young is Associate Professor of Russian at University College London, where she teaches 19th and 20th century Russian literature, culture, and thought. She previously taught at the University of Toronto and the University of Nottingham. A Dostoevsky specialist, her interests in the ethics of narration and the construction of literary space led her to this current research project, which focuses on Russian prison and exile writing. So that's what we'll be talking about today in Writing Resistance. And I'd just like to lead off, as I do with really almost all of my authors, to ask you about your motivation for this project. What got you interested in the topic? If it's Dostoevsky or Solzhenitsyn or something, I love origin stories.
It started out with Solzhenitsyn, really, and seeing a copy of the Gulag Archipelago on my parents' bookshelf when I was a kid, before I could speak Russian, before I'd even started learning Russian. It wasn't something I would have expected to find on my parents' bookshelves, although their library was pretty varied. But it sort of sparked an interest in that topic. I suppose this was also about the same time that Anatoly Marchenko was in the news for his hunger strike and death. And Irina Ratushinskaya was in the news when she was in prison. So it's sort of in the sort of beginning of the Glasnost period when I was started thinking about Russia, started thinking about Russian literature, and I was also reading Gogol, Dostoevsky at the time, and coming across contemporary and recent history about Russian prison and the writing connected with that sort of started a long-term interest in the whole subject. And then that just grew as I sort of became a Dostoevsky scholar, I sort of began to realize that for me, Notes from the House of the Dead is really a fundamental text. It changed so much in his outlook. It changed his writing as well, I think. And so really sort of moving from there, I was looking on the one hand at the Gulag, on the other hand at Dostoevsky, and everything sort of coalesced in this subject area.
Yeah, I think about a lot of those classics, classici. I wonder if Vera Figner also played a part in this, or if you could maybe talk about Memoirs of a Revolutionist. This is sort of the classic that I get to assign to undergraduates. is that sort of a measure for you when you were beginning to kind of choose your writers?
I think I actually came to Vera Figner somewhat later, and coming from the opposite direction. I first became very much aware of her as a writer from reading Evgenia Ginzburg's memoirs Into the Whirlwind. And when she's in solitary confinement in the 1930s, she mentions Vera Figner's memoir several times and sees that as a real touchstone for her own behavior in prison and her own survival. And so I went to Figner via Ginzburg and very much sort of with a growing awareness of how one group of prison inmates in Russia in their memoirs always describes looking back to the previous generations and their incarceration and how they survived it and how they wrote about it. So Figner's memoirs became really important in that respect as a sort of, in a way, sort of in tandem with Dostoevsky's, that the writers, the survivors of the Gulag in the 20th century look back to their predecessors in the 19th for models to how to write about this subject. And Figner became so important in that. It's an extraordinary sort of rich memoir. I mean, I also now assign it for my students as part of looking at the populists for my Russian thought course. She's one of the memoirists who sort of more broadly looks at her career as a revolutionary, and there's some extraordinary analysis of what's wrong with the Tsarist system.
Exactly. Exactly. And I have a lot of questions about radicals and populists and the trials. I guess my next question for you is to introduce the fortress. So perhaps you could tell our listeners here on New Books Network a little bit about the Schlüsselburg Fortress. When was it built? And then what period in its history are you covering?
Okay, so actually might need to consult a few notes here. The fortress is on Lake Ladoga, it's just outside St. Petersburg. It's been there sort of since 1323, when the original wooden fortress was built. And the island that the fortress is on, the island basically sort of, the fortress covers the entire island. And that's changed hands several times over a couple of hundred years. And then, in fact, over 400 years, I think, with the stone fortress that we know today being built in the late 15th century under the Novgorod Republic. The final capture by Russia took place under Peter the Great in 1702, and the original name Rieshek was changed to Schlüsselburg at that point. And then really very quickly after Peter the Great finally took the fortress, its military function ceased and it became a space for incarceration. And the first prisoners arrived there in 1711. And from then on, really, apart from very short periods between 1711 and the February Revolution of 1917, Schlüsselburg Fortress was used as a high security prison for some of Russia's most serious offenders, including state prisoners convicted of political crimes. So it has a long history of incarceration. The period I'm interested in, the period I've been looking at specifically in the book, is between 1884 and 1906. And what happened was, having been used for incarcerating political prisoners up till about 1870. The fortress actually fell out of use in the 1870s. And right. Then the assassination of Alexander II in 1881, the decision was taken to sort of bring the fortress back into use as a prison, and a new prison was built on the island for the revolutionaries who were convicted, who were arrested and convicted following the assassination of the Tsar.
Yeah, I was thinking about this upgrade that you talk about, because in the period that you're covering, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a period of modernization within the prison complex system. And there's also this larger context, which I hope you could speak about, with the political trials. So the trial of the 14, the trial of the 17, the trial of the 193, or the trial of the 20, as they're all sort of called. Could you give us that sense of context maybe, and tell us what was happening in, say, the late 70s to the early 80s when it gets this upgrade?
So I think there are two areas of different areas of context here. One is the sort of the carceral history, in which we might actually place Schlüsselburg in a sort of wider history of what's going on in carceral reform in Europe and the United States, even, where particularly with the Eastern State Penitentiary in Pennsylvania and in England with Pentonville Prison. Already early in the 19th century, you've got this move to single cell, solitary confinement, and you silence very harsh regimes that are sort of associated with the ideas of forcing prisoners to sort of contemplate their crimes and come to sort of repentance, and the sort of the type of total surveillance that we see in, you know, so particularly identified by Michel Foucault in Discipline and Punish, that's associated with these very harsh regimes. So on the one hand, Schlüsselburg's new prison, is part of that process that's going on elsewhere. And certainly it was a huge change for the Russian penal system, which is very much based on communal incarceration and the sort of exile incarceration that involves sending people vast different distances across Siberia and sort of isolating them through distance. And Schlüsselburg brings the prisoners back into sort of very close surveillance, both in terms of the prison itself and in terms of its proximity to Petersburg. So there are lots and lots of inspections from higher officials. So it fits into that context of the modernization of prisons in the 19th century that was happening in many places. But at the same time, this type of extremely harsh, isolated regime was in fact very similar to what had already been going on in Schlüsselburg for the last 150 years. And particularly in the earlier 19th century with prisoners like the record holder for Schlüsselburg was the Polish freedom fighter Valerian Lukasinski, who spent 38 years in solitary confinement in the fortress, which is just unimaginable. So there's already this long history of very harsh solitary regime in the prison. On the one hand, it's a modernization. There's a process of modernization, but also sort of actually continuity with the old system.
Yeah, I think you answered the question perfectly, and that's where I would like to go with the content of your book. So could you tell our listeners and our readers to who your characters are? So you have four chapters. You have an introduction, which I think is marvelous, on surviving Schlüsselburg and writing resistance. I love the appendix at the end, by the way. I think this is incredible as a kind of prosopography for all the inmates from 1884 to 1906. And you give this impression that the 38-year sentence was extraordinary. I get the sense that the prisoners who were there on the average were there for a much shorter amount of time. But the meat of your book, if you will, is the three chapters on Wolkenstein, Aschenbrenner, and Pankratov. And I wonder if you could introduce these people and these writers to us. Who were they and what drew you to their writings?
So the prisoners who were incarcerated between 1884 and 1906 were populist revolutionaries who were convicted in the years following the assassination of Alexander II and the rounding up of the remaining members of the People's Will. So there were 68 prisoners in the fortress, of whom roughly half died. Most of them very quickly, because conditions were so terrible. And of the survivors, a large number, more than half of the survivors, wrote memoirs. So I started this process of reading these memoirs, coming to them via Vera Figner's very famous memoirs of a revolutionist, and you sort of gradually realised that this was actually an extraordinary body of work. It's so rare to get this a set of memoirs by such a large proportion of the prisoners telling this sort of this complete story of their experience there. And I eventually chose three memoirs for the book. And in a way, they sort of came to me overnight that I should use these three. And then I sort of looked at reasons for not to use them. But I decided I was right.
That's a perfect answer. Yeah. So you had an enormous amount of literature, right? And there's a process of exclusion. But I'm interested in that. So what finally, you know, made you decide on these three? Kakrishili.
I mean, first of all, Ludmila Wolkenstein, I couldn't leave her out. Because there were only two women who were long-term prisoners in the fortress. Vera Figner, who was there from 1884 to 1904, and Ludmila Wolkenstein, who arrived at the same time as Figner and was one of the defendants in the same trial, the trial of the 14, as Figner. And she was transferred out of the prison in 1896 and sent to Sakhalin Island as an exile. So, you know, we have so few memoirs by women prisoners and by women revolutionaries. Yes. It would have been extraordinary to leave that out. Apart from that, she was also the first of the prisoners to write about the fortress, because she was one of the first group to be transferred out in 1896, and her memoir was first published in 1900. So, you know, as the first memoir and a memoir by a woman, I had to include it. I also really felt that she'd been forgotten by, you know, if she's remembered at all, it's as this sort of sidekick to Figner, which is really unfair. I think, you know, when you read the memoirs, you sort of realise that actually, you know, I mean, Vera Figner, I think for many of the prisoners, was this sort of huge, this extraordinary guiding light, a sort of, you know, a real moral centre for them. But I think Figner, you know, talks about Wolkenstein in exactly the same terms. And she also sort of played that role for the other prisoners, I think. So it was it was really important to include her. Also, a very interesting character from the point of view of how she came to the revolutionary movement. She was a young wife and mother. Her husband was a Ziemstvo doctor. He was a defendant in the trial of the 193, and who'd been taken part in the Going to the People movement in the 1870s, been arrested for propaganda activities. He was acquitted, but it sort of that experience radicalized Wolkenstein, and she joined the revolutionary movement. So she's an interesting figure in her own right. My second memoir is by Michael Aschenbrenner, who's one of the members of the Military Centre of the People's Will, a guards officer. He came from a sort of Russified German background and from the nobility, and became sort of interested in socialist ideas through attending university lectures, and then got involved in a reading circle and so on. And his memoir, I love his memoir because it's so rich in detail. it tells us so much about the fortress and about the particularly about the intellectual work that the prisoners did once they were sort of freed from the worst aspects of solitary confinement that characterized the first years. And you know, he really characterizes the life in the fortress as a sort of sociological experiment. He's really interested in the types of behaviors, the group behaviors that exist amongst the prisoners. So he's talking about all the work they're doing, whether that's translating books that they're reading, learning new foreign languages, or working on allotments. But he's also sort of thinking about it in terms of what it tells you about the sort of types of behaviour that you see in the fortress. And so I thought that was really worth including, you know, just because of its real richness of the content matter. The final memoir is by Vasily Pankratov, and it's just extraordinary. I mean, Pankratov's he was the youngest prisoner, and he was one of the few from a very ordinary poor workers' background. A lot of the prisoners were from the nobility, but Pankratov was very much not from that background. He was, he was a worker who got involved in the revolutionary movement, and he, whilst in prison, for him, it was sort of his chance to become really well educated, which he wasn't before. But his writing is just incredibly lively and almost actually funny in places, which is not what you expect from this subject matter. But he gives a real sense of the dramas that they went through, and there's lots of dialogue, lots of action.
I was curious to ask you perhaps if you could talk a little bit about the everyday kind of Alltagsgeschichte, the everyday life of the prisoners, and what kind of regimes that they had in solitary confinement, what they read, what they were fed, those sorts of things.
The everyday life of the prisoners changed quite a lot as time went on. In the early days, they were in absolute solitary confinement. They were allowed out of their cells once a day for around 30 minutes exercise. They were not allowed to see any other prisoners during that exercise. They weren't allowed to talk to the guards. And when any of the higher authorities came to visit, they stood behind the authorities, including the prison commandants and the superintendent of the guards, always stood behind two sentries so that they were separated from the prisoners. Prison authorities, when they spoke to the prisoners, would always refer to them in the familiar form T. They would never use V. And they would never allow the prisoners to talk about any other prisoners. They always said, there is nobody else here as far as you're concerned. So they were sort of in these conditions of extraordinary solitary confinement, no contact with the outside world, effectively no contact with their guards either. And in the early days, they weren't given any work at all. They had no means of occupation. They weren't barely given any reading material. If they were given reading material, it was religious tracts, which were interesting to some of the prisoners, perhaps, but quite often, to many of them, not at all. And the idea was that they would sit and contemplate their sins and change their ways. This was a life of extraordinary monotony, with nothing to relieve it, in cells that were bright and clean. They had plum toilets, which was actually quite extraordinary, and another way in which the prison was very modern for its day. But they were extremely small. There was barely any room to exercise in them. It's not clear in the memoirs exactly when this happened, but at some point, the corners of the cells nearest the door were blocked off with bricks, so that the prisoners couldn't hide from the guards. All the doors had spy holes in them, and the guards would, they wore soft boots so that they couldn't be heard in the corridor, so they could spy on the prisoners without giving them any warning. Although, given that the prisoners had nothing to do, it's not clear quite what they were supposed to be spying on. The cells were incredibly cold, about 10 degrees. Oh gosh, that's 10 degrees centigrade. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit. I'm sorry.
It's Celsius. Yeah. Yeah, that's cold.
That's cold, yes. And the food was dreadful. The amount spent on food was tiny, and it was practically inedible. And all the memoirs comment on this.
Yeah.
So conditions in the first days were really, really pretty bad, and many of the prisoners died very quickly. But one thing that sort of really sort of changed how their everyday life worked was the ability to communicate by knocking on the walls using the Russian prison alphabet, which is famous from many people have read about this.
The Bestuzhev, right? Was he the inventor of the tapping system? I don't remember.
He was indeed, yes. And it appears in his memoir, as one of the Decembrists. Many of the Decembrists spent a few months in Schlüsselburg in 1827 before being sent to Siberia. Bestuzhev was one of them, and it was indeed he who invented this system in Schlüsselburg prison itself. And then it's written about in so many memoirs, including of the Stalin period and the Gulag. So it's something that's sort of quite famous, and really the prisoners in Schlüsselburg, once they were able to communicate this way, it was impossible at first because they were occupying every other cell of the 40 prison cells in the block. They were at first arranged so that they couldn't tap on the walls to each other, but gradually the prison filled up. And they were actually able to communicate. They immediately started tapping on the walls. They were punished at first, but it gradually just became normal for them to do that. And gradually the punishment stopped, basically because they couldn't punish all of them at the same time.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. That's an important lesson, I would say.
Yes.
I mean, in the communal experience that you describe so well, right? The power or agency that a lot of the prisoners had, and I guess, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I was thinking that in this communication system that you describe really well, the prisoners must have realized this quickly, and then the guards began to look the other way, seeing that there was nothing that they could do, right?
That's exactly right. So the guards essentially, punishment involved being taken to the punishment cells in the old prison, but there were only 10 cells in the old prison, so there wasn't any way of punishing the prisoners effectively. And again, this is one of the sort of lessons of this. If you have a regime that is so extraordinarily harsh that a lot of the prisoners just felt, actually, if that was to continue, there was nothing left worth living for, and it was either die a slow and miserable death, which is frankly, what happened to many of them, or you fight back and accept that they won't be able to punish you all the time. And that is indeed what happened. So eventually they describe tapping on the walls as, you know, sort of becoming a right. Mm-hmm. But that established communications that sort of made them into a community. And mm-hmm. even though, you know, they talk about this incredibly laborious system of tapping out each individual letter with a number of taps according to where it appears on this little grid for each letter. But nevertheless, they had extensive communications, conversations. They played chess via this system. Right. They exchanged poetry. You know, so they had time on their hands. They could do, you know, they had nothing to do except tap. So it didn't matter if it took a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, you know, I remember, this is completely anecdotal, but the first time that I read Ginsberg's memoir, how amazed I was with the story of poetry and memorization and her power of imagination in remembering, you know, Pushkin. I just in reading a lot of these memoirs, I was struck by their stories of the journals that they acquired and the books that they managed to secure. And as you say, one can get tired of reading the Bible or these, you know, like what they're fed in terms of like the moral transformation literature. I was, you know, especially astounded when they're kind of demanding just really ordinary pieces of literature, history, things that weren't in the prison library. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that, because there's certainly this transformation, as you describe, from alienated subjectivity, however you might call it, into more of a communal life and a communal cause.
So yeah, they gradually establish this communal life via tapping on the walls, and then later, sort of, the regime was relaxed. I think, you know, this was a process of the prison authorities realizing that if they carried on with this incredibly harsh regime, eventually, you know, there would be nobody left to for them to guard, and so they had to sort of allow the prisoners a sort of a more relaxed regime. So they gave them work, they gave them allotments, and they, you know, this inevitably led to more interaction between the prisoners and them being able to see each other. So sort of relaxing that system of solitary confinement, and you know, a big part of that of their activity once they once the regime had been relaxed was their intellectual work. So they were they depict the library and the books that they were allowed to read as a constant battleground. They're always trying mm-hmm. to get better reading material. When they started, yes, there's a few religious books. Then they're allowed history books, but mostly of the ancient world, and certainly nothing after the 18th century. And they're sort of constantly trying to get better, more interesting books, more varied books. They eventually are allowed to subscribe to journals, and they're sort of reading, they're getting things in different languages and learning languages, and then translating books so that their sort of fellow prisoners can read things in from languages they don't understand. And it's a sort of real flourishing of activity in all sorts of fields. Obviously, you know, they're very interested in politics and sociology, and you're sort of eager to get material on those subjects. It's not always allowed, and again, they're always fighting for these things. But you know, when they get access to books and journals, there's also a sort of real flourishing of their own writing. They're writing journals, producing journals themselves, writing articles about contemporary situation, and producing literary works as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also, this is a completely different question, but I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about those who survived. So I guess, you know, this is part of my interest in Holocaust memoirs and survivors memoirs. And I translated, you know, sources, over 300 of them, for the US Holocaust Museum. Yeah. But I mean, I guess, what you have in your, you know, final list of people are a mix of those who died, many of them in 1886 or 1887, and then, you know, people like Pankratov, whose memoirs you have, who actually live very long lives despite all of their ailments and experiences. And I guess my question for you is, on the one hand, you know, what's the difference in memory between those who live long lives to tell the story and then those who can't really speak, or maybe even who've died in the prison?
I think there's a real effort in the memoirs by those who survived to give space for the memory of those who did not. There's a real sort of sense of them trying to record those lives as part of their own memoirs. The memoirs are very much a collective effort. There's very little sense of the individuals. These aren't really individual memoirs of imprisonment. They are about the collective that emerged in the prison. And that, I think, in that they include the people who died, and even if they can't, you know, there's sort of very little to say about them. Some of them, in some cases, they do manage to say quite a lot. I mean, for instance, one of the ways that we see them coming into the memoirs of the survivors is, you know, their voices appear to tell about experiences that the memoirists didn't undergo. For example, Pankratov arrived, he was one of the last to arrive in 1884, around right at the end of the year, and his opening chapter actually sort of he brings in the voices of two of the prisoners who died, Dmitry Putsinsky, who died very quickly, I think he was one of the ones who died in 1886, and Nikolai Pohitonov, who's one of the ones who eventually was transferred from the prison to a psychiatric institution. Right. And died there. And they tell, they're depicted telling the other prisoners how they felt when they first arrived. They thought that as they were being transferred from the Peter and Paul fortress, that they were going to be drowned. That was the aim. Mm-hmm. They had these fetters on so they could drown them in the Neva. And it's a sort of form of it's what Barbara Mitzal calls mnemonic community, in which the later members of the community are sort of brought into those stories told by the older members. And it's something that you see for example, in Grigory Gershuny's memoir as well, when he comes into the prison very much later in 1904. Mm-hmm. But he also, in his first chapter, describes that history of the last 20 years, and talks about the people who died, who he never met, and but he's getting that history from the survivors at that point. So it's sort of they see themselves as this community, and that focus on memory of those who didn't survive is really important.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, in putting Russia into a larger context of prison memoir literature and carceral geography, because I'm really fascinated by this field, that there are ways to understand the persistence of this communal culture, for lack of a better description? I mean, it does seem to be like the revolutionary cause, or plural causes, well after the revolutionary years are over. And now I'm really putting words in your mouth, but just as a provocation, I mean, what is there to write about for carceral geography? I mean, it's really, you have so many people of so many different walks of life imprisoned in this one fortress, and multi-ethnic and multi-confessional and everything in between. So what could the Russian experience offer to that larger world of study?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. On the one hand, Schlüsselburg is a unique place in the Russian context, but on the other hand, it sort of also speaks to a lot of wider issues within sort of Russian incarceration, the Russian penal system, which is why Vera Figner's memoir in particular had so much resonance for later generations of prisoners. On the other hand, there is this sense also of Schlüsselburg mirroring something that we have seen elsewhere, and really, the main sources of comparison I've found that I think really resonate here with the political prisoners of the apartheid regime in South Africa and Robben Island, and the, again, political prisoners in Northern Ireland in the Mays prison in Belfast. So it is this sense of community and shared identity that is, I think, the most significant sort of source of comparison. And I think particularly on Robben Island, you've got the same type of isolation from the outside world that an island fortress prison can bring. And I'm sure that's actually the same as something that we might see if we compared it with some American examples, but not political prisons.
Well, Guantanamo comes to mind, absolutely. Right? Yeah, for sure. I really like that idea of comparisons. I was thinking about Padre Kenny's Dance in Chains as an example, and I wondered if you could maybe recommend both primary and secondary sources. So I'm thinking, first in terms of when we began the conversation about Vera Figner and maybe some of the correctives, one could imagine, especially adding gender analysis would be one path forward, Judith Pallett's work and things like that. But both in terms of primary and secondary sources, and I think our New Books Network listeners will be curious about this, what sort of things might you recommend?
Okay, I suppose secondary sources first. I'd recommend Daniel Beer's House of the Dead, his history of Siberian imprisonment and exile, just for a sort of really sort of a long view of the imperial prison system that really sort of covers so much. And I think sort of it's important for various reasons, including its emphasis. He has a real focus on the Polish prisoners from both the 1830s and the 1860s, which is something that they don't tend to appear as a focus of literature on Siberia in the imperial era. So I'd recommend that. And then again, you mentioned Judith Pallow and her work, also the work of Laura Piacentini on Russian prisons, both contemporary and historical. They are sort of really important writers and researchers who are doing incredible stuff. And Judith Pallow's new project, Gulag Echoes, as well, has that sort of emphasis on the sort of continuities of the system. And I think this is something that a lot of people don't tend to sort of realise. And I think what we see in the Russian prison system now has so many continuities with with the Soviet era, and that had so many continuities with the imperial era as well. So we can look at what's happening today and trace its connections back to the 1830s and the Decembrists, the 1850s and Dostoevsky in prison. There's an awful lot that's still very similar. Primary sources, I'd always recommend Dostoevsky's House of the Dead.
I knew it. You fell into my trap.
Yeah, I'm sure I did, yeah. What else am I going to say? It's the starting point for so much of this topic. And his analysis is really of the sort of the moral aspect of imprisonment.
Right.
What it does to human beings is really something that I don't think has been bettered even today. I mean, people have written different things, but and I think one of the things that's really interesting for me about how the Schlüsselburg prisoners write about the prison and what they contributed to Russian prison writing is that Dostoevsky's very very much emphasizing this moral question. You're the human being in prison. For the Schlüsselburg prisoners, it's the state acting against the individual. That's what's real, or indeed the state acting against the people per se. And that's that idea of the state as immoral, as corrupt, is a really, really powerful one.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, of course, in our age of Zoom and the pandemic, what it took for you, I guess, you know, both like physically and emotionally to write a book like this. And I wonder if you could say something about that. You were in the finishing stages of this, I know. And, you know, this is a lead in, of course, to plug your current project, which I hope you could explain. I mean, what the history of prison with all these continuities means to you, and what kind of research you're doing.
Revising the book for publication, all that happened during the pandemic, and it really was, you know, it changed how I viewed the book as I was going along. Not that I viewed the isolation of the pandemic as anything comparable to what the prisoners experienced. But Ludmila Wolkenstein at one point does say that anybody who's experienced quarantine in hospital or that type of isolation has a sort of intimation of what it means to be in solitary confinement. And as somebody who was shielding, because I'm extremely clinically vulnerable, and didn't see other people outside my house for many months, it was an insight into that type of experience that I really wasn't expecting, and that really sort of brought home to me how psychologically draining and challenging that is. So it's sort of this is something that was really a new experience for me, but it's sort of it fed into a sort of long-standing interest in carceral literature, Russian carceral literature, and my wider project, which is I am primarily a literary scholar. My interest sort of started in this topic by coming across a copy of Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago on my parents' bookshelf, and in the context of Glasnost, hearing about prisoners like Anatoly Marchenko and Irina Ratajkinskaya. Right. But it's always been, for me, the memoirs, how people write about this type of experience, how they think about where they fit into the tradition of prison writing in Russia, and sort of look back to their predecessors, and indeed how Russian literature developed, and this again goes back to Dostoevsky, the flourishing of Russian prison writing sort of developed alongside the flourishing of Russian literature more generally. And it is has always been a very, very strong theme within Russian literature. And so it just, what didn't seem to be a very particularly ambitious project when I started, but then I realized it's actually a huge project.
Exactly. Well, look, Sarah, I mean, you're writing a canon, and then, I mean, it's nothing less than that. You're writing a canon, and then you're revising a canon. This is a project that could be thousands and thousands of pages.
Absolutely. Right? And it's a project that doesn't end, because, as I realized, when I started it and when I first sketched out the book that I'm still writing, the epilogue on post-Soviet incarceration and writing of that, quite short. And it isn't anymore, because there's a whole new body of literature that has appeared in the last 10, 15 years that you've both looks back on previous the previous experience of incarceration and the literature of that era, most recently so books like Zuleika and Hamid Ismailov's The Devil's Dance, which really I thought was a profoundly exciting book. So there's that sort of work that looking back to the Soviet era, and there's writing of by more recent prisoners as well.
One could bring it up, I'm sure, to the present with Sentsov and Navalny and Pussy Riot and others, I guess, you know, where to stop would be another question, right? I mean, where would you stop?
Well, I haven't yet. It's the answer to that.
Exactly. Well, and on that note, I think this is a good place to stop. So this was a real pleasure talking with you. And the current monograph, I'll just mention what you're working on is provisionally entitled Russia's Carceral Text, right? Dostoevsky, yes. Shalamov, and Beyond on labor camp narratives. Am I right about that?
Yes. Yes. And that is a work in progress. And you know, writing Resistance did sort of interrupt that. So I shall be going back to finishing that off, I hope, soon.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, cool. Thank you so much. We've been speaking here on New Books Network with our guest today on New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. Our guest is Dr. Sarah J. Young. The book that she's written, and I congratulate Sarah, is called Writing Resistance, Revolutionary Memoirs of Schlüsselburg Prison. This is published by University College of London Press 2021. It's also available at Open Access. And thank you so much for joining me, Sarah, here today.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
And I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here on New Books Network. Until next time.